If you work hard in high school and get good grades, you can get into a top college even if you come from a poor or working class background, right?
If you're a poor or working class kid, it's very unlikely that you're going to be at one of these highly selective institutions at this moment where we know that those institutions are the thing that can level the playing field so effectively.
That's Paul Tough. We talk with him about his terrific new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Then we re-air my 2015 interview with Christina Rizga about her book, Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It, and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer, Francesca Rhiannon. Paul Tough's last book was the bestseller, How Children Succeed. Its focus was younger kids and how parents and schools can help them realize their academic potential. Now, in his new book, The Years That Matter Most, Tough turns his attention to higher education. He asks the question, is the American system of higher education fair? Or is it designed to protect the privileged and leave everyone else behind? Drawing on new research, The Years That Matter Most reveals how the landscape of higher education has changed radically in recent decades. Federal and state governments have slashed funding for public colleges and universities, forcing them to raise tuition to heights that rival private institutions. Top colleges select for high test scores, so those students whose parents can spend thousands on test prep crowd out less privileged applicants. Add to the mix the favor shown to legacy admissions and, above all, to wealthy students who can pay full freight, and access to college becomes ever more narrow for minorities and the working class and poor. Paul Tough says that in a time when a college degree is a basic requirement for almost any good job, the current system is making inequality worse and stifling social mobility. The Years That Matter Most tells the stories of poor and working class students trying to find their way with hope and frustration through the application process and into college. It also explores what some colleges and universities are doing to level the playing field for them. In addition to authoring four books, Paul Tough is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and other publications. Well, Paul Tough, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Great to be here.
This book is absolutely terrific, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. You start the book with a story of a young woman named Shannon Torres. Tell us about her and why you open the book with her story.
Yeah, Shannon, when I first met her, she had just finished her junior year of high school and was getting ready to start applying to college. And she was a kid who had been thinking about college sort of her whole life. She was an extremely good student at a not well-resourced high school in West Harlem. She lived in the South Bronx. And she had been this kid who just worked incredibly hard in high school, all through middle school and all through college. She really put a ton of pressure on herself. And all of that pressure had built up toward college admissions. And so I happened to be interviewing her, meeting her at a park near her school on the day that the Ivy League acceptances came out. And actually, I knew that they were coming out that week, but I actually didn't know when I made this plan to meet her that they were going to be coming at that moment where I actually was sitting there with her. So the opening scene of the book is the two of us sitting on this park bench in a park in Harlem as she checks her phone and waits to find out whether she got into a couple of Ivy League colleges and especially the University of Pennsylvania, which had become her dream school.
Tell us a little bit more about Shannon and why she really typifies the kids that you looked at in this book, The Years That Matter Most.
Yeah, well, she is someone who had come to believe that whether and where she got into college was going to be the thing that defined the rest of her life. The book is really about the intersections of these two ideas, higher education and social mobility. And by social mobility, I just mean what economists mean, which is the ability of young people to rise above the station of their birth. So if you grow up in poverty or in a working class family, what do you do? How can you reach the professional class or the upper classes? And for a lot of people in the United States right now, there is a strong belief that it's higher education that allows you to do that. And there's lots of evidence in economics that that's the case. And Shannon really believed that. She had really internalized that. She believed that if she got into one of these colleges, she would be able to escape the really difficult financial circumstances that she'd been born into. And if she didn't, she wouldn't. So that just put an enormous amount of pressure on her at that moment.
Right. And as you say, we're told that college is essential to social mobility. You've indicated, yes, it is. But the story's a lot more complicated than that. It's not just going to college. It is where you go to college, which was surprising to me because back when I went to college, you could go to a whole range of colleges and it didn't make that much difference. What's changed and why?
So, I mean, I feel like I should say first that I feel like, you know, there was lots of evidence that I found in economics and sociology to back up the feelings that Shannon was having. But I don't think they're entirely, it's entirely true that you can't achieve really powerful social mobility at a good public university. I think, you know, especially a student as good as Shannon, she would have had that opportunity wherever she went. But it has become more true, I think, certainly since I was in college, that higher education has stratified. And so the rich institutions and the most highly selective institutions have gotten richer and more highly selective. And other institutions, including a lot of public universities, have become less selective and less well-funded. And students have really responded to this by changing the way that they apply to college. And so high-scoring high school students who have really high SAT and ACT scores, they are now much more likely to choose from a very narrow range of the most highly selective institutions and to feel like other colleges are not something that they would consider. And as that has happened, it's led to this overall stratification of higher education that has led to sort of a clustering, not just of high-scoring students, but also of affluent students at a smaller and smaller number of institutions.
And the U.S. has become a less socially mobile society.
Yes, in many ways that is true. I mean, I think you can see these same patterns of clustering all over the place in terms of K-12 education, in terms of neighborhoods. You know, I think we have become, I'm not the first person to notice that affluent Americans have been separating themselves from the rest of the country in a way that wasn't true 50 years ago. And I think what's happening in some of these most selective institutions of higher education is a reflection in some ways of that broader national trend.
Yeah, and that's what is so fascinating, how you go into that in this book. You know, early on you talk about Raj Chetty, who used big data to parse out these kinds of the relationship between social mobility and where you go to school. Talk about the results of his study and what his study was and its results.
Yeah, Raj is an amazing economist. He's, I think, done more than anyone else to push forward the use of data in helping us understand exactly how mobility works in the United States today. And higher education is one of the institutions that he's focused on. And what his big breakthrough was figuring out how to use data from the IRS, tax data, going back many decades to show exactly how mobility works. So he's able to track the incomes of parents and grandparents of today's college students and then watch as college students go to a particular institution and then enter the workforce in early adulthood and see what their incomes are. And so he's able to create this remarkable statistical portrait of higher education as a whole field and see how different institutions affect the mobility of different students. And, you know, what he finds is that selectivity and mobility really go together. And so when low-income students are admitted to selective institutions, they do experience great mobility. They're much more likely to end up doing well economically as adults. Going to any particular institution tends to really shrink the advantage that affluent kids have over non-affluent kids. But what he discovered, the that's sort of the good news, that universities do work as an instrument of social mobility the way they used to. The bad news in his data is that those low-income students just aren't getting that opportunity very often. He also was able to demonstrate, as no one else was able to before, how difficult it is for low-income students to get into these most highly selective institutions, what a small percentage of the student body at these most selective institutions comes from the bottom couple of quintiles of the economic distribution. So if you're a poor or working class kid, it's very unlikely that you're going to be at one of these highly selective institutions at this moment where we know that those institutions are the thing that can level the playing field so effectively.
Yeah, and in fact, Paul Tuff, you found out in this book, The Years That Matter Most, that there is a suspiciously consistent percentage of the students who are, of these kinds of students, poor students and students of color who are admitted to the Ivy League schools, 8% across so many of them. What is keeping these kids from being admitted to these schools in larger numbers?
It's a big question, and it's not clear. I mean, I think you'll hear different answers from different places. Yeah, that 8% number that you mentioned, this was something that a scholar from California discovered, which was that if you look at Ivy League and similarly selective institutions, almost all of them have almost exactly 8% of their student bodies made up of Black students. And you know, about 15% of any high school graduating class is Black, but all of these institutions just sort of magically all fixed on this one number. And so to him, that suggested there was some sort of quota above which these institutions are not willing to admit more Black students. No university would admit to that kind of quota system, but the numbers really are quite striking. And similar things are clear when you look at Raj Chetty's data. And in his data, he's looking at not race, but economics. And the percentage of students at these most selective institutions that come from the bottom two quintiles, more or less, you know, the lower class and the working class, it is, you know, ranges anywhere from about 2 to about 6%. It's a tiny portion of the freshman class at any of these institutions, and that there aren't a lot of outliers. There aren't a lot of highly selective institutions that do anything differently.
Yeah, and you talk about an admissions industrial complex. What is it? How exactly do the schools choose students to admit?
So that phrase, the admissions industrial complex, is one that I heard from an enrollment manager, a head of admissions who I met, a man named John Bockenstedt. And when I met him, he was running admissions at DePaul University in Chicago. He now works for Oregon State. And he's great. He's a first generation college student himself, I think a really conscientious admissions person. But he also runs these two blogs where he analyzes the data of admissions and gives his opinion about admissions in a way that not too many other people in the field feel free to do. So he's very frank, very analytical, and to my mind just has a vision of how admissions works that is really important. And what he helped me understand was that, you know, when you're looking at admissions through the point of view of students, which is how, you know, I did a lot of my reporting, sitting with kids like Shannon Torres, who we talked about as she's waiting to hear the admissions decisions that will change the course of her life. From her point of view, these admissions people are all powerful. They're these sort of demigods up on Mount Olympus making all of their very arbitrary decisions with nothing but power. But when you hang out with admissions people, and I went to some conferences where they gathered, they don't feel that way at all. They actually feel like they're under enormous pressure. They feel very stressed out by the way that admissions works right now. And a lot of the institutions they work for are under enormous financial pressure. About a quarter of private universities in the United States right now are operating in the red, spending more than they're bringing in. And for most of those institutions, the pressure to change that falls on the admissions office, because what they need in order to make their budget is more tuition. And the way that you get students to pay tuition is through admissions. So the admissions industrial complex is actually a place that is very anxious right now. And understanding the pressures that those people are under helped me understand better why some of this stratification seems so chronic, seems so difficult to change.
Yeah, you talk about financial aid and financial optimization. Tell us how that works.
So financial aid optimization is this very mysterious process done by, you know, math PhDs using complicated algorithms. And what they're able to do is to analyze. So they work for these consulting companies that admissions offices at different universities and colleges contract with. And using their algorithms, they tell admissions people how much financial aid it will take to get any given student to accept your offer of admissions. One of the things I hadn't really understood until I started spending time with admissions officers is that there is this thing called yield in admissions. And yield is what percentage of the students who you offer admission to actually accept your offer. And that number has been going down consistently. It's now below 30%. So if you are an admissions person and you offer 1,000 students admission to your class, only about 300 of them are going to accept. And that is incredibly nerve-wracking for an admissions person because you don't know whether you're really going to hit that 30% or whether it's going to be 20% or 40%. And what that number is makes a huge difference to how your institution does next year. And it's not just how many, but which ones. You need the ones to accept your offer who are going to help you in all the ways that your freshman class always helps you, paying tuition, keeping your, all of your statistics that you report to U.S. News where you want them to be. And so it's these financial aid optimization gurus who analyze the applicant class and help admissions people make the decisions they need to make to get the class that they want.
And so that means rich kids and it means kids with high SATs. Is that right?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, it's a little more complicated than that. But what was remarkable in my reporting was how much even, you know, once you go through all of these complex algorithms in financial aid optimization, the basic principle that so many admissions people have to follow is you've got to admit more rich kids. And part of that is just simple economics. It's those are the kids who are most likely to be able to pay tuition, which you need more of if your institution's going to stay afloat. But it's also true that there are lots of other incentives in the system that push admissions people toward admitting more well-off kids. And some of those have to do with standardized test scores. So standardized test scores, the ACT and the SAT, correlate really highly with family income, much more so than GPA, than high school grades. And there are lots of incentives in the system that push admissions people to admit kids with high test scores. That's what U.S. News rankings depend on more than anything else. That's what, you know, your alumni, your trustees are able to look at and say, you know, is your selectivity going up or going down? And there is lots of evidence out there that those test scores are not the best way of measuring which students are going to be the best fit in your college or going to succeed the most at your college. But there is nonetheless a lot of pressure to admit kids with those highest SAT scores, which are often the kids with the most family resources.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point because, you know, as you said, it correlates with wealth, not necessarily, and it correlates with wealth, we have to say, because people are paying $400 per hour to folks like Ned Johnson, who you write about in the book, in the test prep industry. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not just about test prep. I think that there is, the kind of schools that wealthy kids go to, they tend to be the ones that are most well-resourced. They tend to have families who are really focused on those standardized tests. So it's not just test prep that people like Ned are able to provide. But yes, I spent some time with this great SAT tutor named Ned Johnson, who runs a company called Prep Matters in Washington, D.C. and its suburbs. And being with him and watching him teach lots of his students and talking to those students helped me to understand how, just exactly why those correlations between family income and SAT and ACT scores are so powerful. I was able to watch him, you know, help students, affluent students, raise their scores by really significant percentages and get access to the kind of schools that they wouldn't have had access to without that. And, you know, he's really good at what he does, and those students were really hardworking and smart. But still, watching that process in action makes it much more difficult for me, and I think for anyone, to take seriously the idea that these scores are the best measure of which students really deserve admission to the most selective institutions.
Tell us more about that, because one of the things you talk about in the book is how kids, poor kids, you know, who work really hard and get really good grades in school, in fact, do well, even at elite colleges, academically.
Yeah, so that was something that was clear in the research and the data, but it was also clear in a lot of the stories of the young people who I met. So yeah, there's clear evidence that the most predictive data point of how well a student is going to do in college is his or her GPA, the high school GPA. That's probably the single best predictor. But it's also, I met lots of kids who have what they call discrepant SAT and ACT scores, meaning they have really high GPAs and sort of middle of the road SAT or ACT scores. And what the College Board's data shows is that students who fit that profile are more likely to be low income, first generation, black or Latino or Latina, and female. So, and I met a lot of kids who met that description, including Shannon Torres, and they are kids who don't have a lot of advantages, but tend to work extremely hard. That's why their GPAs are so high. And when these kids get to school, you know, they sometimes struggle at first, especially if they're admitted to a highly selective institution that has a very different kind of culture and student body than they're used to. But academically, they really thrive. So despite their low test scores, once they get to those colleges, the ones I met did fantastically.
And yet there are other barriers for these students, psychological barriers that come to bear on things like completion rates. Nationally, only 60% of college students complete a degree, and that's worse for poor students. You spend a lot of time in this book, Paul Tough, talking about the University of Texas and its innovative programs that it is doing to change this, to improve completion rates. Tell us about that. Why is it necessary to do these programs? What do they consist of?
See, the University of Texas is a really interesting institution. It's probably where I did the most reporting of any university in all of the ones that I visited. And one of the reasons it's most interesting is there's this law in Texas passed by the legislature called the Top 10% Law, where if you are a Texas high school student and you're in the top 10% of your class, now it's actually shrunk to the top 6% of your class, in terms of your GPA, you are automatically admitted to the University of Texas at Austin. And that's not true for flagship state institutions in any other state in the country. Other flagship institutions tend to use the same sort of admissions standards that elite private schools do. They care a lot about SAT and ACT scores. But if you're in the top 6% of your class, even at a, you know, really under-resourced high school in a poor community in Texas, and you'd have that great GPA, you are automatically admitted to Austin. So those students are great students because they're in that top 6%, but they often don't have the same kind of resources as kids who are coming from, you know, the rich suburbs of Dallas or Houston. And they get to the University of Texas and they often struggle. And in the past, what UT did was what I think most institutions of higher education did, and many still do, which is they thought this wasn't their problem. I think that universities sort of have this sink or swim mentality, which is it's part of the job of colleges to, you know, weed out the chaff, to separate the students who are really belong in college from those who don't. And that I feel like that belief really goes deep in a lot of higher education educators and administrators. And at UT, they started to take a different approach and said, well, no, we actually think that all of these students can succeed. We know that they're great students because they got to UT. And the fact that so many of them are not graduating, and especially aren't graduating in 4 years, is an indication that we are not doing a good enough job, not that they are not doing a good enough job. So I followed this one administrator named David Lottie, whose job it was, beginning about 7 years ago, to improve the 4-year graduation rate at UT from about 50% where it was to 70%. And he had 5 years to accomplish this goal. I've been reporting this book for a really long time, so I was able to watch him as he went through those all those 5 years and finally did reach that goal. And there were two things I thought that were interesting about what he did. One was that he decided to focus his energy on those first generation and low income students who were automatic admits to UT. And he concluded he was sort of like that himself when he had been a college student. He'd felt really out of his element. He had come from this working class community in the Central Valley of California to this very elite institution in the South. And so he could relate to what a lot of these students were feeling. And mostly his conclusion was that it wasn't really academic problems that were tripping them up. It was financial problems, emotional, cultural, just this sort of the strangeness of being in an institution that was so different from the place where you grew up. And he felt like this is something that colleges and universities can do a lot to help students overcome. It's a real problem, but it's not an unsolvable one. That if you give students the right kind of support, and that sometimes means tutoring, it sometimes means mental health counseling, but more often it just means, you know, the kind of messages that create for students a sense of belonging, a sense that, like, yeah, I really do belong here. This is my community. I am a Longhorn. I am a University of Texas student. When you can send students those messages in effective ways, they thrive. They do great. They don't drop out. And so over the course of these 5 years, UT was able to make really remarkable strides in their graduation rates. And lots of other institutions around the country are now doing the same thing, putting more emphasis on the university's responsibility to help their students graduate.
And then there are the students who themselves are taking on this issue. I was really struck by the story of Kiki. This is a young Black girl who had tremendous instability in her growing up, but was early on flagged as being very bright. She had to fight to be in classes that were appropriate to her level of potential, academic potential. She ends up in Princeton, you know, the top of the top, and yet also has a really difficult time emotionally, socially there. But she begins to develop a way out of it, and other students like her are doing that as well. Talk about her, and also talk about efforts like IVG.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Kiki, I felt really lucky to be able to follow Kiki for a few years as she finished high school and started Princeton, in part because she's a remarkable student, but as much, I think, because she was really thoughtful and candid about her own experiences growing up and then her experiences at Princeton. I mean, I think the reality is that social mobility, important though it is in any country's economic health, is really difficult when you're actually going through it. So when you're a young person at the end of high school, going from a low-income family and getting the kind of education that you need in order to reach the professional or the upper class, it is just emotionally painful. It's jarring. You're leaving behind everything you know. You're often, it often, you know, leads to complications or conflict with your family. It really changes your sense of identity. And so that was what I talked to Kiki a lot about as she was going through her freshman year. There have always been kids like that. I think the few low-income students at these most highly selective institutions. What's different, I think, now is that those students are kind of taking that on as part of their own identity. They're no longer just suffering in silence and thinking they're the only ones to have that experience. There's this organization you mentioned called IVG, which is this student organization that exists at every Ivy League college and many other similarly selective institutions. And these students meet once a year at this conference and have other communications both within each campus and beyond their campuses throughout the year. And it's allowed students to take on this identity as first-generation students at highly selective institutions. First generation meaning that their parents did not graduate from college. And you know, their stories, I think, are tremendously positive and important. You know, they really are the ones who are experiencing social mobility. But the way in the past that they'd been made to feel at their institutions was, you know, feeling like outsiders, feeling ashamed of where they'd come from, feeling embarrassed by their past. And now that they've sort of found each other and are able to influence the way that their institutions operate as well, they, I think, are often feeling more comfortable, more at home, more of a sense of belonging.
Now, We just heard that the Trump administration intends to cut $8 billion from the education budget. And I, you know, thought as I was reading your book, Paul Tough, The Years That Matter Most, I was thinking about how my mother went to Brooklyn College for free. Public colleges used to be free or very cheap. You write a chapter about the GI Bill. And we are a long way from the GI Bill. Tell us about the importance of that bill in building the American middle class.
Yeah, so I knew the GI Bill existed, but I had never really looked at the history of that era. And so I got to do that, got to understand it better, and also had the great experience of talking to some, I went and found some veterans who had fought in World War II and had gone to college on the GI Bill. And these are guys who are now in their mid-90s, so there are fewer of them around than there used to be, but their stories are really remarkable, not only their stories of war, but their stories of education. And the GI Bill era, I think, was important to me because it was this moment where the American government and the citizenry, the people, the taxpayers, really felt like higher education was a collective good, that it wasn't. I think right now we tend to think of it as a luxury good. We tend to all of our opinions, all of our worldview regarding higher education is as this competitive marketplace where we're all trying to get the best for ourselves and for our kids or for our institutions and forget everybody else. And the GI Bill, it wasn't a perfect era. It wasn't a perfect bill, but in many ways, it represented this very different vision of what higher education means and what place it holds in the United States and for Americans. And it was this moment where we felt like if kids in our neighborhood, if kids in our country, if kids in our city are getting educated to high levels, that doesn't just benefit them, that benefits all of us. And that's still true. When you look at the economic data, there's no question that having more well-educated young people would help us in all kinds of ways. But I think now we don't, in terms of the public and those Trump numbers that you just mentioned, lots of states, as well as the federal government, have cut their higher education budgets in recent years at exactly the moment where we need to be spending more on higher education and better funding, especially low-income and first-generation students. And I think we're doing that because we've stopped thinking of public higher education as a collective good. And I think if we can recapture some of that spirit, not only of the GI Bill, but of, I also write about this movement called the high school movement earlier in the 20th century when communities came together to, for the first time, build free public high schools. It was that same sort of feeling that our collective public education benefits us all. And if we can think that way again about higher education, I think we can make great strides to improving our economy, improving our democracy, and getting rid of some of stratification and competition that right now is so powerful in higher education.
Yeah. And so as a very last question, you don't really give specific prescriptions in this book, but I'm going to ask you anyway. What do you think of the Sanders and Warren programs for free public college tuition and canceling student debt?
I think there are some good instincts behind them. I think the idea of having the federal government be more involved in helping students pay for and succeed in college is a great idea. The problem for me with those specific proposals is that they are not means tested. They are, as far as I understand them, they're for everybody. And the problem right now with making college free or with canceling student debt is that most of the people who are going to college and most of the people who are taking on student debt are affluent kids. And so the problem that we really face in higher education is an unlevel playing field. And something that just right now canceled all student debt would actually make the playing field less level. What we need to do instead, and so again, I think those instincts are good. I would change the direction of those policies somewhat to focus on the institutions that right now are serving low-income and first-generation students the most and are incredibly underfunded and are really struggling as a result. If we put more money into those public universities and into our community colleges especially, I think it would have exactly the effect that those politicians are hoping for, and I think it would be more effective than the specific policies they're proposing right now.
Well, Paul Tough, I want to thank you so much. This is absolutely a fascinating book. I learned so much from it. The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Paul Tough. Go to writersvoice.net to read his recent op-ed in the New York Times about the college admissions process. Next up, a high school in San Francisco with an impressive track record on educating poor, minority, and immigrant youth. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Back in 2015, I interviewed Christina Riska about her book, Mission High. It's the inspiring story about a school in the heart of San Francisco's Mission District that's educating a highly diverse and low-income student body, and succeeding in sending 75% of them to college. The school is a real community brought together by a common commitment to excellence and to supporting each student's path to learning. Here's an edited version of that interview. Well, Christina Riska, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's really great to be on your show.
You spent 4 years at Mission High School in San Francisco researching this book. It seems like a truly wonderful school. Give us a snapshot of the school just to begin.
Yes, it's an incredibly diverse school. It's one of the most diverse schools in the country. There are students who speak 48 languages there. It's a school that, like many our urban schools, educates very high numbers of low-income students. 75% of students are poor. 45% of students are Latino. 15% are African-American. 25% Asian-American. And 40% of students are English learners, which means that they've been speaking English for less than 2 years. And while, you know, according to its performance on standardized test scores, it's not doing that great, and it was, you know, placed on a list of low-performing schools. When you look at other quantitative and qualitative data, it's very hard to label it, the school, as failing. So, for example, even though it educates so many low-income students, 75% of students are enrolled in colleges this year nationally. For poor students, that number is usually around 55%. Graduation rates are some of the highest in the district. Attendance is very high. 90% of students in surveys and parents also say that they like the school and would recommend it to others. It's a much higher average percentage than, you know, other district schools that often post, you know, much higher test scores. And then there's a lot of qualitative things, and this is really what I, you know, the reason why I wrote the book. I wanted to kind of highlight all these invisible qualities. So, for example, if you walk into Mission High School, right off the bat, you're just going to notice that there are high standards. There's, you know, staff that's incredibly committed. There's a lot of love and care within the building. And you also notice that even though it's a very diverse school, it actually has very little segregation within the school, which I've certainly seen in other diverse schools in the country. And it has to do, you know, those are very deliberate designs within the school to create more integrated classes, to make sure that Latino and African American students have access to honors and AP classes. There's a lot of multicultural clubs. And so you don't see the typical, you know, segregation along racial lines that you would see in other environments with teenagers in other schools. There's just this sense that students view themselves, you know, they're not there to kind of just, you know, get to the next thing. There's a real sense of community and leadership. And, you know, every student seems to be involved in volunteering or running a club or solving some kind of a problem within a school. So there's incredible student engagement academically, but also in terms of their community.
Now, you show many examples of students' work. And in fact, in many ways, it felt to me like this is a book, Mission High. This is a book as much about teaching as it is about a school itself and a certain approach. You show a lot of examples of students' work that is really quite extraordinary. I was impressed by many, but tell us about Jasmine.
Jasmine was one of the first students I met in Mission High School, and you know she's an incredibly astute, brilliant African American student who grew up in one of the most struggling neighborhoods in our city. It's a historical African American community, Bayview Hunters Point, and she lives in public housing. You know, she's raised by a single mom who often works 2-3 jobs. And Jasmine also grew up witnessing definitely a lot of she experienced a lot of loss in her family. Her father was killed in an accident. A couple of her friends were shot while she was growing up. And at the end of high school, her best friend and her boyfriend was shot and killed, which really derailed her from her path to college. So she's definitely, on the one hand, she's one of the most struggling students and, you know, represents a lot of typical stories in urban schools. But on the other hand, she's this incredibly resilient and brilliant student whose story illustrates how what needs to happen to help students like Jasmine succeed. So Jasmine would often contrast her experiences in middle school versus high school. She went to a high-performing middle school in one of the most affluent districts in San Francisco, in the Marina District, and she was one of 6 African-American students there, and she had mostly Fs and Ds there. She was flagged by the district of, you know, risk of dropping out. And she said that she basically felt that teachers at that school didn't know how to work with African-American students. They didn't care if they needed extra support. And they either, when Jasmine had extra questions in the class, they would either ignore her or treat it as a disruption rather than a wish to engage with the material. So by the time she got to Mission, Jasmine was doing much better. And, you know, in the 11th grade, I watched her present 2 papers. The first one was she did an oral history of her community. Her community was from the South, and they migrated to the Bay Area. And she talked to her boyfriend's grandmother about the Great Migration, but also about growing up in Tulsa and witnessing some of the worst race riots in our history that happened in 1921 in Tulsa. And she interviewed her about her experiences of growing up there and what the community was like, and educated, you know, her classmates and myself included, even though I'm a history major, she educated me about that time in our history. And then about 6 months later, Trayvon Martin got killed in Florida, and Jasmine was on her spring break, but she insisted that she really wanted to switch her research topic and focus on this issue. And so she wrote this incredibly sophisticated paper about the root causes in achievement gaps, and that then essentially lead, you know, to higher suspensions of African American students, and then higher rates of incarceration among African American young teens, but also of course adults. So you know, when I asked Jasmine, what was it different about Mission High that allowed her to thrive and succeed? She said that first of all, it's obvious that at Mission High School, there are a lot of conversations that happen among teachers around what does it take to successfully educate all students in the school, right? And what does it take to help struggling African American students in particular? And she said that it's often about sort of small, specialized skills or changes in your affect. You know, she said, for example, how one of the most important things that set aside effective teachers at Mission High School who succeed with African American students is they don't look at Jasmine as a person who has all these problems, you know, violent neighborhood and experience with violence within a family, or, you know, a past record of D's and F's and low test scores. that's not what dominates their view of the student. Teachers work very hard at Mission High School to notice all of the strengths and the potential of their student every day. So a lot of teachers actually at Mission don't even know about a lot of these issues that Jasmine told me personally, because what they focus on is they focus on her work. They provide a lot of opportunities for her to show her intellect, participate in discussions. They look at her student work, but they don't spend hours and hours talking about all of her family and neighborhood problems. So some of it has to do with affect, and a lot of it just has to do with strong skills to know how to work with students that have different level of skills and motivation, and knowing how to help them, you know, improve their writing, improve their vocabulary, and increase their academic confidence.
Yeah, and a lot of this teaching is actually based in neuroscience. You have a very interesting discussion in the book, Christina Rizka, in your wonderful book, Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It, and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph. Such a true and wonderfully descriptive title. What's the neuroscience that backs up this approach to teaching?
Yes. There's so much. We're learning so much about how students learn and what works in learning and teaching. And I would say one of the most striking findings is that students don't learn when it's a kind of a teacher-driven sort of top-down classroom where, you know, in so many classrooms, teachers to this day continue to mostly talk and lecture, and maybe at the end of the class there's an assignment, an activity, or a lot of these activities are assigned as homework. And there's not, in many classrooms, there's not that much variation in terms of activities. What the research in neuroscience tells us is that students learn in the long term when they're allowed to engage with the material emotionally and intellectually and from a variety of formats and perspectives. So this again gets at into kind of the craft of teaching, but some of the most effective classrooms in Mission High School, and, you know, effective teachers, neuroscience now is sort of confirming what experienced teachers have known from wisdom and evidence for decades. But it's really great that we now have neuroscience behind this. But the most effective teachers set up classrooms that have a variety of activities. There's a mini lecture. There is an opportunity to reflect on what students just read or heard in small groups or in larger groups. Then there's usually, it's followed by a collective discussion. There are a variety of written assignments. You know, you're not just going to sit and practice the same skill over and over again until you're bored to death. You know, there will be, in Ms. McKinney's class, you're going to respond to short questions about the article you just read. Then you might do a quick warm-up exercise in analysis as you prepare to work on a larger research paper. There's going to be a quick, fun vocabulary exercise. In other words, there's a variety of activities because science tells us the students don't, after 15 minutes of the same thing, most students, high school and college, tune out. This is what teachers refer to as the rhythm and the pace of class, right? The number of activities and how are they sequenced and how long each of these activities last. And this is really kind of gets at the heart of these specialized skills that teachers need to have to set up effective classrooms that teach skills, but also are intellectually engaging.
You mentioned how diverse a school is, and I'd like to, this is another, I think, very important part of this book, Mission High, is to talk about how diversity is celebrated. I was very moved by the story you tell of Pablo and his speech at the school. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about him and how, you know, this is a case where it's not diversity around race, but diversity around sexual orientation.
Pablo is a courageous gay student and activist from Guatemala who moved to the United States in 2008, and he was incredibly shy. He was a math nerd. He barely spoke English. And over the course of 4 years, I watched him blossom into one of the most incredible and inspiring activists and leaders I've encountered in my life. And I think his story shows so much how a school can be set up as a place that brings out the best in students, you know, helps them get to know themselves, and through their stories and their life, kind of teaches very important messages about social inclusion and acceptance to other students. So first of all, there's a very strong support from the teachers at Mission High School for the Gay Straight Alliance clubs. But there's also a lot of other clubs that Pablo joined that explicitly throughout the school celebrate diversity and celebrate the positive things that come from that. Then there's a lot of training for teachers how to create classrooms that there's zero tolerance for any sort of racial slurs or homophobia or sexism, and very, you know, explicit rules about how teachers respond to that, but also how teachers themselves model values of inclusion and acceptance and standing up for others. But then there's also, you know, throughout the school, teachers spend a lot of time thinking about what kind of content they're going to use and include in English classes, in math classes, in chemistry classes that will reference the stories and the experiences of the students that they're educating, and that will allow them to engage in conversations and discussions that, again, promote the values of diversity and acceptance. And I think what, you know, Pablo's story illustrates, you know, he went from being one of the most bullied young people in Guatemala, and then, you know, having a similar experience at First Admission, to someone who created one of the most effective gay straight student alliances in the country. And in fact, you know, Mission has very relatively few bullying instances. There are, compared nationally, one in five gay students report being bullied, and those numbers are much, much lower at Mission. But I think Pablo's story illustrates how hard it is going to be for our country to reduce bullying or racism, right, or exclusion of anything in a school that is homogenous or segregated. This is where the value of a diverse school, I think, become most visible, right? Because we can read all the stories and books we want about the harm of racism or the causes of racism, but there's nothing like spending, you know, 4 years in a diverse school and learning from personal experiences of other students and understanding what it means to stand up for others, what it means to have an inclusive community, and what you gain as a human being from being surrounded by that diversity.
In her book, Mission High, Christina Rizga says America's obsession with high-stakes testing doesn't really work to evaluate student accomplishment.
In the United States, the people who dominate education reforms come primarily from business, you know, and today they come primarily from business community, and that includes tech community. And they're essentially insisting, you know, there's got to be a way to measure learning and measure the value the teachers add. And so we're going to really focus on creating systems that help us measure that and track progress. And then schools that can show measurable progress will be the model for how change should happen in every other school. The reality is, of course, so much more complicated, but also interesting. And essentially, you know, what I found out is that some of the most important things that matter in a quality education and that help students succeed at Mission High School, things like emotional intellectual engagement with our content, ability to problem solve, ability to communicate effectively and collaborate with others, curiosity, creativity, resilience, all of these things that science today tell us are some of the most important things that increase achievement, but they cannot be measured by standardized test scores. these are the things that increase achievement the most, but they're very hard to quantify in a standardized manner. And so in most classes in the United States, they're overlooked, especially in schools that, like Mission High School, educate high numbers of struggling students, because the pressures on these schools to focus on test scores are much greater than a school that educates affluent students. But I've reported in so many other schools over the course of my 5 years writing for this book and Mother Jones magazine, and I see, you know, hear the same story from affluent and low-performing schools, that the emphasis is so much on standardized tests, and that means that teachers kind of design everything around that rather than these other harder-to-detect things that are invisible to the outsiders and that matter in the quality education. No other high-performing country, you know, like Finland or South Korea or Singapore, place so much emphasis on standardized testing. We have more standardized tests in our schools than any other industrialized country, nor does any other high-performing country invest so much money into creating these tests, you know, measuring students and also measuring teachers. All these other countries are emphasizing building up the capacity of teachers to do that kind of bottom-up work that I described in the beginning of your program, right, where teachers themselves look at the local data, including the kind that, you know, cannot be measured but can be detected by a professional who understands pedagogy, who understands child psychology, who understands, you know, teenage brain and how they learn their specific subjects. They can see that stuff. They can detect it. But a business person or a tech, you know, superstar is never going to be able to see that.
Christina Rizga, talking to Writer's Voice in 2015 about her book, Mission High. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview. Coming up next week, we talk with Daniel Werb about his book, City of Omens, A Search for the Missing Women of the Borderlands. It's a kind of scientific detective story into the causes of the epidemic of femicide, the murders of women in Tijuana, Mexico. The book casts new light on immigration, human trafficking, addiction, and the true cost of America's empire building. Remember to tune in next week to Writer's Voice to hear it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.